Okay, next case for argument, Pierce v. Colvin. Mr. Schultz.
Please, the Court, Your Honors. Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Terry Pierce. Ms. Pierce alleges that the ALJ made errors of fact and improper and unsupported inferences in support of his credibility determination. He failed to make provide any explanation or analysis for the specific findings he made in the residual functional capacity assessment for Ms. Pierce, and that he failed to analyze the opinion of the treating chiropractor, Dr. Duarte, pursuant to the appropriate rulings and regulations. At page 20 of the administrative record, which is page 41 of the appellant's appendix, the ALJ discusses a number of the factors which led him to find Ms. Pierce not credible. The ALJ discussed the fact that her treating doctors had prescribed that exercise for her, that she go walking 3 times a week for 20 to 30 minutes, so that she work up to that. Ms. Pierce testified that she had not yet started that because it was difficult for her to do anything additional beyond her part-time work. But then the ALJ made this finding, quote, "The fact that the claimant's treating physicians believed her to be capable of engaging in such exercise is a further indication that they did not find the claimant's pain to be disabling, and that the opinions of the claimant's treating physicians were not necessarily reliable," close quote. Well, there's no reasonable inference from a doctor prescribing exercise that meant the doctors did not believe that Ms. Pierce's pain was disabling. I mean, doctors prescribe exercise for severely impaired patients all the time. That's one of the things they might prescribe, especially for musculoskeletal impairments. In addition, the ALJ relies negatively on the fact that Ms. Pierce did some exercises while lying in bed that her physical therapist had given her. She described them as laying in bed and raising her legs up and rolling to the side. And again, the ALJ makes a negative inference from the fact that she could perform those exercises. But that's an unreasonable inference. And this court has held in the Carradine case and the Clifford case that the ability to engage in prescribed exercise that's prescribed for treatment does not allow for an inference that the claimant is not disabled.
I think the main problem with this case is the lack of actual medical evidence of a severe impairment. All the testing, both clinical and the MRIs and so forth, showed mild, at best, impairment.
The medical terms are mild. That's correct, Your Honor. But where there are bulging discs, and in this case, the 2006 MRI shows that at one level the bulging disc was effacing the thecal sac and the exiting S1 nerve root.
Right, and she's treated for that, and she gets relief.
Right, in 2004, and then she was released to return to work in 2005, and she did return to full-time work. She then re-injured herself, and unfortunately, at that point, she no longer had health insurance, so she was able to see the chiropractor for a little while. Her doctor sent her to physical therapy, but she was only able to attend 2 physical therapy sessions when they wanted her to attend between 8 and 24 sessions. And I think the physical therapist's treatment notes may be the most important evidence after the 2006 MRI, starting at page 344 and then 345 of the administrative record, because the physical therapist notes that Ms. Pierce has difficulty straightening up after she bends over, which is consistent with what Ms. Pierce testified to. She had significant pain. There was tenderness to touch over the muscles. Maybe more importantly, she had only what's called 3+/5 strength in the entire left lower extremity. And 3/5 strength means a person can use the muscle to engage, but only against gravity, not against any resistance at all. That's a pretty significant weakness. Those are findings that the administrative law judge did not grapple with. And additionally, in this case, the ALJ found in that boilerplate language that this court has criticized, but the first part of that boilerplate is that the ALJ found that the claimant's medically determinable impairments could reasonably be expected to cause the symptoms that she alleged. And based on that, he then had to make a proper credibility finding, and that's why I'm pointing out some of these things that he relied on that really don't allow for a proper negative credibility finding. In this case, Ms. Pierce was working part-time at the time of the hearing and had been working part-time, 4.5 hours a day, at a school lunch program, so she didn't work in the summers. And the ALJ found that because she was working part-time, if she was given a sit-stand option, he reasonably inferred that she would be able to work full-time. But similar to the discussion in the last case, Ms. Pierce testified that she had significant problems even working the 4.5-hour shift, that she was the only cashier who was allowed a stool so she could sit or stand. When she stood, she had a crate, because she could only stand if she lifted a leg up and put it on a crate. When the ALJ asked her if she ever worked more than her 4.5-hour shift, she said occasionally, which the ALJ got wrong in the decision. He said she often worked more than her shift, and she only said occasionally. But in addition, she testified that whenever she worked more hours, and sometimes even when she worked her normal shift, she was, the term she used was crunched over when she got home, in severe pain, took a hot shower, had to sit down, elevate her legs, ice her legs, and that was just working the part-time work that she was doing.
Could you talk to us a little bit, Mr. Schultz, about the subway part-time work? When did that happen? How long was it? The government is telling us that they agree the ALJ erred in his discussion of that.
Yes, that was in December of 2006 into, I believe, January or February of 2007. So it was about a two-month period. Ms. Pierce attempted to work another part-time job to supplement her income, and she had to quit the job because she was unable to physically sustain the...
I thought she just was absent so often. Did I miss that?
She may have said that. It might have been a mutual leaving, but it was because she was unable to sustain the work physically. Mm-hmm. So that was another, the ALJ erred in finding that she often worked more than her shift, and then he failed to discuss the limitations that the plaintiff indicated she had doing even the part-time work. The facts here are different. Ms. Pierce at all relevant times, or at least as of the ALJ's decision, was 55 years old, so if limited to sedentary work, unless she had transferable skills to sedentary work, she would be found disabled. In addition, in this case, we have an opinion from a treating chiropractor who had seen the plaintiff many times, I think at least over 20 times during a two-month period when he provided an opinion. And that opinion included that Ms. Pierce could only lift 10 pounds. The ALJ never mentions the chiropractor by name. He doesn't mention that the chiropractor opined that she could only lift 10 pounds. And he dismissed all the treating source opinions in one general sentence that they weren't supported by the evidence. But he doesn't go through that checklist of factors. And in Phillips versus Astru, which we cited in our brief, a non-precedential case, this court recognized that Social Security ruling 06-3P requires an administrative law judge to weigh opinions of non-acceptable medical sources, such as chiropractors and treating physicians, with the same analysis that they must weigh treating physician opinions. And the ALJ doesn't discuss how often Dr. Duarte had seen Ms. Pierce, what types of treatments he provided, the nature of his specialty, which is dealing with musculoskeletal impairments. We believe that's another legal error.
Okay, so you used the phrase chiropractic physician, wasn't it, in your brief?
He's a chiropractor.
He's not a physician?
No, he's a doctor, a D.C. doctor of chiropractic.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Neltner?
May it please the Court, my name is Andrew Nelton and I represent the Acting Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. What the ALJ had before him was a claimant whose daily activities involved 4.5 hours of work, sometimes 5 or 6, 5 days a week. She said she couldn't work more than that because of her back, yet when the ALJ looked at the evidence, he found minimal treatment notes. There were mild imaging.
But is Mr. Schultz correct that she said she occasionally works more than 4 or 5 hours?
That is correct.
But the administrative law judge said often.
That is correct. And the government. Well,
couldn't that be a significant difference?
The government doesn't think so, Your Honor, for basically two reasons. One is that I think it's hard to quantify the difference between often and occasionally without further information as to.
Well, why didn't he ask her? What do you mean by occasionally?
Those are terms that actually have. Those are terms of art for ALJs, right? Where in the RFC evaluation, there are things that you can do occasionally, sometime, occasionally and often and always.
I believe you actually are correct, Your Honor.
So not the kind of thing that you'd expect an inadvertent error.
No, but the government still argues that the error would be harmless in this instance, especially as to this. The amount of work that she did, the government argues, was just not the largest, didn't serve the foundation for the ALJ's decision. The ALJ was aware that she could work, but then this goes into the ALJ's lack of discussion of the subway job and her time there. The majority of the ALJ's opinion focuses on her treatment, the medical evidence, what she reported to her physical therapist, what the state agency physicians found. Ultimately, it's the government's position that the work at Subway and even whether she worked over the 4.5 hours occasionally or often just wouldn't tip the balance in this case.
Well, I'm looking at that paragraph of the ALJ's opinion, and she often ends up working for even longer. She's given the option to sit and stand. The undersigned believes that if the claimant is given this option in any other job she might perform, the objective record demonstrates she could perform it on a regular and continuing basis. In terms of saying, well, if she can do this often, I think she can do it every day. And that logic is, I think, pretty transparent. But if it's based on a factual error, how do we dismiss it as harmless? I'm looking at page 7 of the ALJ's opinion. The bottom third of the page. So.
Right. I think that in this case, what the ALJ is talking about is you have to look at the opinion as a whole or the ALJ's decision as a whole here. And that even though the ALJ might have focused in that particular sentence on the sit-stand option and that she was given this at her.
That option business is very. That bothers me because it sounds as if what the ALJ is saying is, well, what's she complaining about? They let her sit down. But it's much more complicated than that because according to Mr. Schultz, and this is common for people who have these back problems, the sitting is more painful than the standing. So it looks as if, you know, she sits part of the time and she pops up and so on. That would be consistent with having a serious back problem. But the ALJ doesn't discuss that. He doesn't say what the option means.
I think that in this case, the ALJ did find she'd had a serious impairment with her back. Indeed, that's the foundation.
What did he mean by the option?
I believe he meant that she could sit or stand at will at the occupation identified by the vocational expert.
Why didn't he say, look, if her only problem is that if she sits, it becomes painful, but they let her pop up whenever she wants. Now, if they said that, no problem because she can stand when the sitting becomes unbearable. That would be fine. But I don't know what he meant about the option. You put it together with the occasionally often, and it just makes you wonder whether the ALJ was really responding to the facts.
We would argue that the ALJ was responding to the facts and that building in the sit-stand option to the RFC literally gave required that she be given that option to sit or stand at will whenever she wanted during her hours of work. And that would help accommodate her impairment, which, again, the ALJ did find she had a severe impairment regarding her back.
Did she have that option in the cafeteria job?
That is correct.
And how about the subway job?
The record does not say, but I am presuming that she did not. I think that moving on to...
What was her cafeteria job?
This is the job where she worked at for a school or for a contractor for a school. And
what was she doing in the cafeteria?
In the beginning part of the day, she was helping prepare wraps, sandwiches, and tortillas type thing for the students. And then once the cafeteria opened, I believe she just worked the register. Once the cafeteria actually opened to allow the students in, I believe she just worked the register processing payments.
Well, can you just stand up? What? She sits and she can sit and stand at a cash register?
That is what was...
That doesn't sound right.
That is what was allowed at that occupation, and that's what the VE took into consideration.
But the cash register is at a fixed height. I don't understand how you can... I mean, sometimes you see people standing at a cash register because it's higher. Sometimes it's low and they sit. I don't understand how you can do both.
I would presume that there was a stool at a height that allowed her to sit and literally just stand up and still work at the right height to do the cash register. I mean, all I know is that she was given a stool and she was able to work the cash register and was able to sit and stand at her option. It met the requirements, so to speak. It allowed her to do that job, and I believe she's still continuing to do that job. So there's no doubt that the sit-stand option was feasible for her. So the government argues that there's plenty of information upon which the ALJ could base the RFC. There are the largely normal exams, there's the normal EMG, there's relatively mild imaging. There's conservative treatment, there's no epidural, there's no recommendation for spinal surgery. The ALJ took all this information into consideration in formulating the RFC of light work. As to the credibility issue for claimant, this is a case where the ALJ found the claimant not entirely credible, but did note that she was fairly consistent with her testimony. The ALJ did not outright reject her testimony here, but just weighted against the evidence he had before him in terms of physical therapy notes that her back pain was improving, that it was intermittent, that it was alleviated with use of medication. So in terms of the physical therapy notes, which opposing counsel touched upon, they weren't all one-sided in terms of supporting claims of disability. There's actually a lot of information in those notes that supported the ALJ and that the ALJ cited in regarding her range of motion, the things I just talked about in terms of improving with medicine. Moving on to the exercises that the, I believe it was a clinical nurse practitioner recommended that she do. It's the government's position that the ALJ was not relying on that information to show that she could get up and work. But the language used by the ALJ was
Okay, it says she does exercises for her back, and at the end of the paragraph he said these facts, which include the exercise, also demonstrate that the claimant's allegations of disabling pain are not entirely credible. That's like this sitting-standing business. The exercises presumably are a way of controlling the pain. So why does the fact that she does exercise show that she doesn't have pain?
I don't think that the ALJ takes the use of exercises as showing that she doesn't have
pain. Yes, he does. He says these facts. And he's just recited a bunch of facts, including the exercises, show that she doesn't have disabling pain.
Well, I think that the conclusion is that her claims are not entirely credible. He's not saying that, okay, here we have these exercises, so...
These facts, he's saying, which include the exercises, show that she doesn't have disabling pain. That's what he said.
Well, he says that they show that her claims of disabling pain are not entirely credible. The government would argue...
Yes,
that.
All right, but how does doing exercises show that your claims of disabling pain are not credible? The worse your pain, the more exercises you have to do.
The government
does he think that people with disabling pain can't do exercises?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Why do you say that, then?
Because I think that he believes that the exercises are further indication as to how the physicians viewed what she could and could not do. It's simply a matter of...
No, I know that that's not what he said. He said these facts show that she's not credible. But how does doing exercises show she isn't credible?
I think that
did she testify that she doesn't do exercises?
No, she testified that she does
then
do.
Then I don't get the logic of what he said.
I think that the logic is that if you have someone who says that they are disabled and can't do a certain amount of activity, and then they're able to do certain exercises, that they're able to do some activity. I don't think that ALJ...
No, that is all wet. You might be severely disabled, and you're given the exercises for people who have severe disability. And the fact that you do those exercises doesn't mean it's entirely consistent with your having this disability.
The government
can see that.
The government concedes that doing exercises is not inconsistent with disability, that doing exercises...
So why does her doing exercises cast doubt on her credibility?
I think because the ALJ feels that her claims as to what she can do are at a certain level, that if she could do those exercises, which she does, her claims just cannot be that correct.
Well, I don't believe that. Do you? He didn't say that.
I believe that
no one could do this type of exercise who had the pain that she testifies to.
You are correct. The ALJ does not say that.
Possibly figure that out.
I see that my time is up.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Nelkner. Mr. Schultz, do you have any time left? Because we're sort of running out of time.
And just a couple of points. Unfortunately, Ms. Pierce did not have health insurance at the time when she had re-injured her back, which made it difficult for her to get more treatment. And I think it's critical that when she went for physical therapy, they wanted her to go for 2 months for significant therapy, but she could only go to 2 sessions. And at the time, this is at 345 of the record, her short-term goal was to be able to tolerate 45 minutes of physical therapy with only 6 to 7 out of 10 pain and to report mild improvement in standing erect after bending. Those were her short-term goals. Her long-term goal was for her to be able to participate in her part-time work duties with only 3 out of 10 pain. Those were her long-term goals in physical therapy, but, of course, she never could reach those goals because she had to stop therapy after two sessions. Just wanted to point out one more thing. I forgot to mention that other fact that the ALJ relied in that same page on the opinion from Dr. Franklin that Ms. Pierce could lift up to 40 pounds. But that opinion was given a year prior to the time that Ms. Pierce claimed that she became disabled and was based on her first injury, and she was released to work with a 40-pound lifting restriction. She did return to work, but then injured herself again.
Mr. Schultz, if I could, with my colleagues, let's just ask you one broader question. We've said in a number of cases that it's a problem if ALJs rely upon a lack of treatment, if there's no exploration of the reasons for that treatment. You're on the ground before ALJs a lot, I assume, you in your practice. How consistent a problem is that, since access to health insurance is such a big problem in this country?
I think ALJs frequently rely on that as a basis for denying finding a person not credible without actually asking the claimants about that at the hearings.
Mm-hmm. Without, I didn't hear you.
Without asking the claimants about that at the hearing. I mean, certainly sometimes they ask the claimant why they didn't get treatment, but a lot of times they don't, but then they rely on it in their decisions later on.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel.